Who are you?
Who is he? He's an impy pilot.
Can we just do this, please?
Then do it.
Who
Let's see.
Are you
waiting?
Let me know when you're done.
I'm here to meet a friend. Where is he?
We ask the questions.
Wow. Big move. Now you can ask him who he is.
Maybe I'll get an answer.
That's a stolen ship. There was another pilot here waiting to take it forward.
Stolen for who?
For the rebellion.
Whose rebellion?
Welcome back to Logicgate. I'm your host, Scott. I'm here with my two friends.
Doug.
Did you forget your name?
I did. I was a little bit put on the spot.
And yeah.
I was like, he usually says my name. Why is he pointing at me?
No, that's how we roll now. Well, season two, all different, baby.
I see.
And we're also joined by...
Jason Gilroy.
Oh, man. I would love it if you were related to Tony Gilroy. Can you get me the hookup?
If you want to be involved in the show, you have to be a Gilroy.
It's not related. It's just a weird coincidence.
Yeah.
I did actually see it. There was some random Andor podcast online, and they actually got Tony Gilroy to come on one of their episodes, and I was so jealous. Like, that would be amazing. Like, to actually talk to him about, you know, like, his thought process, because...
Yeah, he's done a lot of interviews and stuff, yeah.
I mean, I would definitely admit that I'm a Tony Gilroy fanboy. I mean, all the stuff he's done has just been chef's kiss of amazingness.
So. Yeah.
All right, we're going to talk about Season 2, Episode 1...
I was thinking, should we just do like overall thoughts of the episode first and then walk through it?
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't write it down. Does anybody know what the episode was titled?
1 year later.
Okay. So what was the deal? Tony Gilroy's doing episodes in three, in chunks of three, right? And each one is a year apart?
Yeah, this is talked about pretty overtly, so it's not like a spoiler, but like, yeah. They released three episodes weekly. So every week they released a three episode chunk, and each three episodes represents a whole year leading up to the Battle of Yavin, you know, so that right now it's 4 BBY before the Battle of Yavin, and every three episodes will be a year, you know, a year jump towards that, which the Battle of Yavin is like Star Wars. That's like where Star Wars starts, right?
Is that, I was going to say, because it opens and it says whatever, 4 BBY.
Yeah.
And I know that's the time period is the Battle of Yavin, but I don't even know what that is. Is that what happens in
New Hope? I don't
know
exactly what battle it is, but I know it's like, it's the big thing in Star Wars.
Is Yavin even in the original trilogy? I mean, I know the name, but it's not like they go to the Yavin planet and that's where Leia's from or anything, right?
Well, if you've seen the first three episodes.
Which I haven't.
You would know. That Yavin, which we may get into. I don't know. Anyway.
I'll do some research, but I mean, I know that the Battle of Yavin is like the defining time period, and I don't know
Yavin
a lot about
is the rebel base planet, as far as I know, like the main rebel base.
All right. You want to talk about, what'd you say, general overview of the episode?
I think that would be good, just kind of like check in. I thought this was kind of way more exciting than the first early episodes of the first season. I remember, it was a bit of a slow burn in the first season, whereas in like right away they get off to kind of an exciting start with Cassian like escaping from the facility and the rebels like fighting and all of these things. So it's very slick. I would say maybe a little too slick. It was like, it's very well produced. You can tell they upped the budget a little bit. I'll say I didn't love the rebel, like that whole fight on that foresty planet with those rebels. That was probably just my least favorite part because those characters didn't seem very well-rounded. They seemed kind of dumb. And also not enough Cyril Karn.
There's basically no Cyril in the first episode, right? I was kind of, looking for that.
The first episode doesn't have any. So yeah, that was a big letdown. But I don't know. What did you think of the first episode?
I'm trying to remember. So how long has it been since the last season? It's been at least 18 months, right? Like I had to like look up. I'm like, where did it end?
Yeah,
I don't even remember. It's been a long time, but I'm with you. Like the production value, that's what I put in my notes. Like this ship right here at the beginning and some of the sets are amazing. Like it's very pretty, but not in like an over the top CG way, like in a well produced way. So,
or like the Chandralin wedding stuff.
Yeah,
too,
I had notes like on that too. I was
beautiful.
Like, what the heck is this? Like, is this place real? Is this CG? Like, this is a gorgeous set if it's real.
Okay, don't get me started on the wedding. But we'll get there.
All right.
We will get there.
The first season came out in 2022, so 3 years ago.
So my first reaction watching this, because I've only watched the first episode, was like it was a Tony Gilroy like love fest all over again, because it's just so pretty and the dialogue is great. There was one part, I know we talked about this before, like the show don't tell. There's the part at the wedding where the one girl is drinking and the other girl basically tells her like, whoa, slow down. This is a 2-day event. You know, which I thought it's so subtle, but it's a really good way to tell the audience, hey, this is not going to be a one and done afternoon wedding thing. This is going to be a long drawn out thing. And it would have been really easy to, you know, like a TV trope would have been like to show on the screen, you know, day one of the wedding or some underhanded way to get out that it was a 2-day wedding. But it felt like a really organic conversation where she was like, hey, don't get totally hammered on day one because we're going to be here for a while. So I was just, again, I mean, it was all a Tony Gilroy love fest of like the writing is good. It just feels tight and it doesn't feel forced, like the characters have to explain to you what's going on. So I was happy.
They just kind of jump in. There's no like pre-roll crawl. You know, they just like, here's 1 year later. Yeah, I don't know. What'd you think of the episode, Doug, number one?
Tony Gilroy made me racist.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an interesting approach. That's a hot take right there. Here,
can we title the episode Logic 8, episode 14, Tony Gilroy made me racist.
Okay.
Well, all right, go ahead and elaborate.
All of that, I'm sorry, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. The culture that has the big prolonged wedding ceremony festival.
Shondrilan? Cinderella Land? Yeah,
whatever. I hate that race of people.
Just rich people, essentially?
No, the whole culture, any culture that does something as stupid as a prolonged wedding like that, having to go through all of that, it just looked miserable. I felt miserable watching it. I hated it. I understand, ethnic and culture and everything like that, but I hate them now.
Really? I love weddings. I'd love to go to a 2-day wedding.
You enjoy your...
Yeah.
It was more than 2 days. It was 100% more than 2 days.
I think it was a few-day event.
The first episode, they only cover first 45 minutes.
I'm going to call BS on this, too, because every wedding that I've ever been a part of, there's a rehearsal the night before, and nobody gets it right. Nobody. Everybody, okay, your job is to walk down the aisle and then stand here. That dude does not stand where he's supposed to. Nobody does. And everybody gets upset because you've been there for 3 hours and people are tired of walking back and forth up and down the aisle. And yet you're going to tell me they had all of that pomp and ceremony perfectly choreographed and timed? No, I don't buy it. Tony Gilroy. Your wedding sucks.
Doug's getting a little bit ahead because none of that is in the first episode. But I will bear that in mind as I watch in the future.
Yeah.
I think the point is that it's stuffy and it's like high stakes a bit, like, because this is a culture, I guess, that's been around 25,000 years.
I hate them.
And I think the point is that it's like everyone's like gilded to the their collars and like their dresses, and every little placement of every hors d'oeuvre is so perfect. And so the idea is that it's very high end, very rich, and really stuffy and oppressive. I think that's part of the feeling you get from watching, you know, a lot of the Mon Moth stuff is it's oppressive and you can't really express your true feelings. You can't really make mistakes. So, yeah, I mean, it's irritating in a certain sense, but it's also like just so beautiful and well crafted. I mean
Mon Mothma is a senator, right? I mean, I imagine that's true to life, right? Like if, I don't know, mm-hmm. who's some senate, right? If Mike Huckabee's like daughter gets married, right? I mean, it's just it's an excuse for a bunch of rich people to get together and pat themselves on the back. It'd be like, I feel like it would be like the Kardashian wedding, right? It's just all the upper crust of society getting together and like, you know, having a dick measuring contest about how many gold Bentleys they have, right? It's just an excuse to show off.
I think it's pretty accurate to, that's what the show is trying to do. So I think we should get into just a quick recap of like the events of the episode.
I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that I think it's accurate if you had a bunch of rich people and a wedding. I mean, it's a good thing to celebrate, like, hey, you know, Kim Kardashian only gets married once. Well, that's not a good example, but you know what I mean? Like, her parents are going to be like, hey, if we were ever going to spend $2 million on a 1-day thing, this is going to be it, right?
Yeah. Also, I hate their kids.
All right.
Yeah,
let's
fair enough. Okay.
Should we get back to the events?
Well, yeah. So just to recap, the end of season one, after Marvel's funeral, Cassian kind of went to Luthen and said, hey, either kill me or I join the rebellion. I can't remember exactly that situation, but basically he finally decides to join Luthen and the rebellion. So here we are 1 year later, BBY4. We talked, it's like 4 years before the Battle of Yavin, which is Star Wars, the movies. We go into a planet called Sinar, which is an Imperial test facility. And there's a character called Naya who's helping Cassian kind of liberate a TIE fighter.
Is that a TIE fighter? I mean, I wasn't sure what that was.
It's a proto TIE fighter.
I mean, clearly it wasn't what I was expecting. I mean, it's like we can see it. It's white.
Apparently it's special, but...
It's very special.
We don't know much about it. We know that they need it for, you know, some specific purpose for the rebellion.
So what's the implication here? Because I was a little thrown off at first. It's basically that Cassian and... What was her name?
Naya.
They've infiltrated the Empire, and they're basically going to steal this ship is what's happened. So in a year since the last, they've somehow ingratiated themselves with the Empire enough that they can... get onto one of their bases and steal their
he's
ship?
Described as a test pilot. So they must have brought him in to test these prototypes. Yeah, I mean, it's just an excuse for him to have a getaway scene and not know how to fly a TIE fighter.
I don't think it's purely just an excuse to have that scene. I think it's also meant to show the depth that the rebellion has reached to where they have people on the inside, even at like... Here's a random person at a test facility, and maybe Luthen or somebody indirectly has converted that person to the rebellion, and they're now working with them. It just goes to show how deep
it tells
the
you
hooks
a lot.
Are
okay, sure.
around the yeah, entire
like
empire.
It tells you that the Empire has gotten so bad that there are defectors, enough for someone like Naya to put her neck out. And like, you know, we know that there's that feeling that the Empire's gone too far, and there's people like Naya who don't seem like heroes, they don't seem like brave people, but they're pushed to their limit. Wait, you know, because this is risky for her.
Are we to assume that Naya is part of the Empire and she's not part of the rebellion also?
We don't know a lot, but I assume that she just works for the Empire.
I mean, she's only in it for, you know, whatever, 45 seconds. I just kind of assumed that they had both were both part of the rebellion.
Well,
there's that
scene where she's questioning what she's doing, and Cassian has to kind of like give her like a pep talk, which makes me think that she's just turning, you know, she's just making a decision then and there, not like she's been with the Rebels. So.
How can you give her a pep talk and just glance over that? That speech gave me chills.
It was great. It was a good
he's talking,
speech.
She's asking, is it going to be worth it? You know, tell me this is going to be worth it. And he's like, it's already worth it. Like, you've already done this. Like, you, by making the decision to rebel against, you know, the Empire, like, you already win. You've chosen to say, no, I won't be subjective to you. I won't be oppressed by you. So you've already won.
Yeah. No, that is good. It's a good little speech. It shows that Andor has gone beyond just someone who's reluctantly participating to someone who's a motivator, a leader, you know. So yeah,
true.
Can we talk a little bit about that ship though? Like when he gets in that ship, like the HUD and the internal, you know, the greebles of that's inside the cockpit of that ship, it looked gorgeous. Like it looked really cool, and like there was a there was a scene, like at some point he's looking, oh, it's when he's shooting the guy with the rocket launcher. Like the actual glass has like target reticles on it. So there's some sort of like, I don't know, 3D hologram HUD on it. Like it looked way fancier than any other ship we've ever seen in Star Wars, at least as far as like modern technology.
I'm going to say this, and if I'm wrong, I'm sure Star Wars nerds everywhere will crucify me for this. Doesn't that ship look like Vader's ship in New Hope?
That's kind of what I was thinking,
which was different than all the rest of the TIE fighters. Is this the prototype for Vader's ship?
It certainly could be. I just thought from like a CG and from like a modern, you know, like if you were going to design a fighter jet, like I thought it looked cool.
Oh, for sure.
No offense to the OG Star Wars, but you know, like the trench run, like the tech that they had back in the 70s, it was pretty minimal. So I just thought this was a cool version of that.
I looked it up a little bit. The only thing I know is it's called the TIE Avenger. So it is a little bit of a special ship. I don't know. A prototype.
It would make sense that it's a prototype.
It's
for
not
Vader's
just an
thing.
Average ship.
Prototype.
Prototype. There you go. Yeah, go ahead.
I did write down some notes. So whatever, Cassian has problems piloting it. So actually, are we to assume that A, Cassian is a terrible pilot,
yes,
or B, that this is such a new ship, just no one knows how to pilot it?
Well,
is he a pilot in anything else?
Yeah, for sure.
Is he? Okay.
That was part of this whole initiation into the rebellion. He joined that other group as a pilot.
Okay.
That was going to be his job, was to pilot the stuff. What were they stealing? Credits? Like a
yeah,
ton of
right.
credits?
Yeah,
right.
Oh, okay. Credits, right.
Yeah. He's the pilot. That's what he's kind of.
So then is the
at.
Implication here so, that like this tech is so new that he thinks forward is reverse and that's why he crashes it?
Well, it's kind of revealed later, and I don't think it's much of a spoiler, but he says, this is not the ship that I was trained on when it's like after the mission. So it's assumed that he's trained to fly TIE fighters, but this is much different than a normal one. So
the one thing I've read, so he basically blasts the hell out. He shoots his way out of the door and then he takes off and he basically gets chased by whatever, two other TIE fighters or whatever. And I wrote down, I think this is the most Star Wars-y scene in Andor at all, full stop. Because I was explaining Andor to my wife. I'm like, hey, will you watch this with me? It's not really Star Wars. It's mostly politics. And then like, this is the first scene. Like
the
there's
first
a,
scene.
This
yeah.
awesome, like basically car chase scene. Yeah. You know, with the guns ablazing and things like
lasers,
that.
Lasers, TIE fighters chasing through
a
canyon.
There was like one scene of a TIE fighter in season one, like flying overhead. Like it was very nuanced.
Well, there was that awesome scene with Luthen getting away from, I think it was a Star Destroyer.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
that
was really cool.
That was very Star Wars-y, but like, yeah, there was very minimal amounts of that kind of stuff in season one.
This just felt like, all of a sudden there's a full on, space chase, I guess, which I thought was cool.
And it's
amazing.
Not just your average Star Wars action either. I think it's like probably some of the best Star Wars action that I've ever seen. Just him crashing in the loading dock, just showing the physicality of one of those spaceships. You've never seen one like mishandled before, and that gives you an impression of just the power of it.
Yeah. Well, and that ship takes a beating too, because he crashes into the ceiling and then the walls. He blows his way out the door.
Yeah.
And then he crashes on this rock chase. He takes a couple wide corners. I'm like looking at this ship going, dude, he's not going to survive this because like this, there's no way the ship is going to take all these hits. But
yeah, he's driving it like a NASCAR.
Yeah, for sure. Right.
Okay. Well, so it's great. Let's move on to the next scene, which is, a farming planet called Mina Rao, where we see B2, Bix, and Brasso. Looks like they're hiding out, and we start out with a scene of a nightmare. Bix is having like a bit of a nightmare. We see images of Dr. Gorst and the torture. So it's a brief. You get the idea of that they've made a home on this farming planet. Cassian is trying to bring the ship back home.
Bix essentially has PTSD from being tortured for so long is what I took away from that scene.
I don't want to nitpick or stall anything, but didn't we pass over the first initial introduction into the stupid race of Chandrillans and
that was culture? After. There might be like
they're real close, quick scene,
but yeah. Next is I'll just describe Chandrila.
Well, hang on. Before we move on, there was one little piece. So on that scene, Bix has that nightmare.
Yeah.
And they basically comfort her like, it's okay. Don't worry. Cassian's coming back. And I forget, what's the name of the little red robot?
B2
keeps asking. He's really nervous. Like, where is Cassian? And the guy has to keep telling him, don't worry, Cassian's coming back. Like, he's really nervous that Cassian is gone.
How did you feel about that scene?
I thought we could just skip over B2. I mean,
that was a small point. But the one thing I was going to mention is, did you guys notice there's a paper picture of Marva taped up inside of that shit? Like, when they're... he was doing something and you can see that they have a picture of Marva like in the ship. I thought that was a cool little throwback.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting. How do you think B2 felt about that picture?
I don't give a shit how B2 feels because he's a goddamn appliance.
And he's a freaking toaster.
He's a toaster. Okay. So after this introduction into that farming setting, we'll go back to there. But Then we are taken to Chandra-La, where you have Mon Mothma.
Is that where they are? Is that the planet? They're on the Chandra-La planet?
As far as I know, that's the location. Yeah, that's Chandra-La. It's a location. Yeah. They're Mothma estate.
So is stupid question. Is Mothma their last name?
Yeah.
Is her husband's name something Mothma? And her, is her first name Mon?
I think so. You know, she just calls her daughter Leda, but I think she's referred to in materials as Leda Mothma.
Okay.
You know, but so yeah, her daughter's having a wedding with, who's that other guy?
I don't even remember.
It's like the Davos Skulden's smuggler dude's son, right?
Davos Skulden's son. I don't think we know the son's name.
Or care.
We see that Luthen arrives on into the event, which surprises Mon Mothma. She did not expect that.
It's worth pointing out that it says this is the Mothma estate. So this is their house wherever on Chandra-La.
Yep.
I mean, like looking at this thing, again, if we're, you know, doing an analogy of the Kardashians, right? Like this is the multi-million dollar, 10,000 square foot house, and they just are throwing their wedding in their backyard, essentially, right?
Yeah, I mean,
and it's gorgeous. It looks like a wedding venue. I didn't realize until we just resaw it that that's actually their house. I thought they had rented a venue or whatever, but it looks really cool. And like, I thought like whatever those circle things were over the stairs, and like it looks like I would want to go hang out there. Like it looks fun.
I
mean, it would be a cool place to have a wedding.
If I didn't have to do any of the wedding activities, sure.
Okay, so we've established Doug hates weddings
and chandrelins.
And chandrelins.
It looks very manufactured and expensive. So we just get that bit of like a introduction to all these characters. And there's Vel, I believe. Yeah, she's the lesbian. That's about, you know, from the first season. There's Clea, the Luthen's assistant there. Takeholma, I don't know if we see him in this one, but he's there.
Luthen shows up and he sees Mon Mothma first and he starts talking to her, and then Skulden comes over and like basically pulls her away because I don't think he knows, or maybe he does, that Luthen and Mon Mothma are good friends, but he's nervous that he's talking to her at all. He's basically
nervous to who? What?
Skulden did not want Luthen talking to Mon Mothma. He pulls him away. He was like,
"Well, that's,
you know,
because that's
don't
because
give away my secrets." Is there more to that that I haven't seen yet?
Well, that's because that they have a secret gift for the wedding. But the tension is that Skulden doesn't know about the arrangement between Mon Mothma and Luthen, because that's a rebel arrangement.
Sure.
So that's the real tension there. Yeah,
and I think it's also worth pointing out in season one, they were, every single time they spoke was
it was very cloak
high
and dagger
security.
Yeah,
like extremely high security. They tried not to linger in the same place together for too long. It was very much a, you know, let's stay away from each other.
Cloak and dagger. Yeah.
So being at such a high profile event right next to each other is kind of a little bit nerve wracking.
Yes. Yeah, you can see
also
Mon
just
Mothma
being at a wedding like that.
Do we know?
We get it, Doug.
We get it. So, do we know where does Skulden stand in relation to the rebellion? Is he pro rebellion, anti rebellion? Does he even know they exist?
No, he's anti. In fact, I get the impression that he's very pro empire. Like he's sort of the right wing, you know, version.
He's okay.
You know, almost he kind of looks like Trump to me. Like he has kind of like the,
yeah, he does have a little bit
like
of
golf course tan,
a little Oompa Loompa Trump vibe
like
to
the,
him. Yeah.
The receding hairline that's probably died. all right. So get that introduction. Then we're back on the farming planet just for briefly again. And we just noticed that there's an Imperial scanner cruiser up above, and we get the impression the Empire is on their way. Then cut back to Cassian landing the TIE fighter on a foresty planet. We later learn I think it's good to know it's Yavin 4.
So this right here is Yavin where he meets those other rebels?
Yes.
Okay.
So this ultimately becomes the rebel base, the major first rebel base, but right now it's, you know, you kind of see the beginnings of the rebels,
sure,
and that's what he's walked into is like early rebellion people kind of like stranded there without food. So Andor,
do they not know? They don't know he's coming.
No,
because he's there to meet somebody else.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then they don't trust him because they think he's whatever, a spy. So they basically jump him.
Well, I mean,
they tackle him to the ground.
That's not exactly unreasonable. He's pilot who shows up in Imperial flight suit, flying an Imperial ship.
True.
Why wouldn't he be part of the Empire?
I didn't. Yes. Yeah, I guess that's a good point. He's wearing their clothes. He looks like. Yeah. Okay. So what was his intent? He was going to land on that planet and meet somebody else and hand over this ship, and he just landed in the wrong spot.
Well, the person he met, I think, was killed by these rebels.
Oh, is that
what the
his contact? Yes, he was supposed to just land there, hand off the ship, and that was the end of his part of the mission. But they killed his contact, and I think it comes out in this episode that they're there due to a what do you want to call it, a mishap. Their leader basically got killed.
Yeah, there was a lot of infighting. You killed my brother, you know, whatever. He was dirty. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which, I mean, I'll touch on that. They were annoying, but I think it was a good representation of this is the early iteration of the Rebel Alliance in the sense that there is no alliance and there's mm-hmm. just a bunch of pissed off people who don't know what they're doing.
And they're basically jockeying for position, right? Because there is no leader. And exactly. Then they get in that big, this is fast forwarding a little bit. They get in that big fight. They shoot each other like, oh, I was clearly the number two. Like, no, hang on. It should have been me. And then they all fight with each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's this, it's not organized at all. The rebellion isn't at this point.
Remember that theme.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about I don't even know what it is. Basically the infomercial for Gorman?
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, that's actually next scene is we go to an Imperial fortress in the mountains called the Malphine Divide, and we see Orson Krennic is directing a top secret mission, and Ben Mendelsohn.
Is it?
Just for all our listeners out there, a quick recap. Krennic was, from Rogue One, he was the officer in charge of the construction of the Death Star.
Indeed, yes. So he's...
Grade A asshole.
Yeah. The scene basically starts like he's giving him a mission briefing and then it just cuts. He's got like basically a PowerPoint presentation and it's like an infomercial for like Gorman spiders that make this fancy silk. Like it's like a solid 1 minute, 2 minute like speech or, you know, like video on like basically to sell the Gorman planet as this high end. You know, they manufacture this expensive kind of like textile there.
It's like a tourism board video.
Yeah, like exactly. Like it's like this fancy, expensive video that's been produced to like encourage tourism to go to Gorman.
You know, that could be a good place for a destination wedding instead of Chandrila.
I
kind of got Fallout vibes from the infomercial, like, because it's so over the top, like almost propaganda of like,
yeah,
you know, how great this is and how resilient the people are. And we've been, you know, farming this spider silk for tens of thousands of years and, you know, it's great. And then it just cuts and it's like, okay, so they also have this like super special material called call kite that, you know, we can get unlimited power from. So it goes from like this, you know, overproduced video to, okay, we're going to bomb the hell out of this whole planet and take this call kite. Oh, I think, doesn't he say, he was like, if we go in and take this call kite, there's a 80% chance that all of the people on the planet that the planet's going to collapse and all these people are going to die. I think he says something about 800,000 people might die. Mm-hmm. And Orson's like, meh, basically, meh, whatever. You know, it's the price of power. We really need this unlimited power this call kite gets us.
But that is the mission, is a PR mission, is to like smooth over the PR nightmare that may come with the unstable planet. So it's a marketing meeting, which I'm familiar
interesting.
With. It's very much like a situation I've been in. Like, here's some bad news that we have, and we need to figure out how to market it, you know, this bad news.
We need to soften the blow that we're going to destroy your entire planet and you'll all probably die.
Yeah, they're trying to come up with a way of making the situation come off okay for the Empire, like PR wise. And it's like, so that's an interesting indication of where the Empire is now, like that they care about PR even at this stage. So, yeah.
I guess that's a good point, because the later Empire would be like, we don't give a crap. We're just going to go. And,
yeah.
I mean, they blow up Leia's home planet without even thinking about it, right?
Yeah, but also they don't blow up Tatooine.
True.
I mean, they could have easily blown up Tatooine, destroyed the plans that escaped down there, but they didn't. Because Tatooine is a stronghold of the Hutts, who control a significant portion of the Outer Rim.
Hmm. Oh, so.
So they do still care a little bit about optics.
They definitely care less, right?
Yeah, sure.
The fact that the Empire is having a PR meeting at all about how we have to go destroy this planet, that's hilarious to me. Because that's what they do. That's their bread and butter. Like, we know where they get. They get so bloodthirsty and big that it's like, we don't really care how many people we kill. But here they're like, well, maybe these spider people in the silk, we should maybe tread lightly.
I also need to point out, Tony Gilroy's brilliant. But this whole plot line, he stole from Futurama. From the Democratic Order of Planets, mined out all the dark matter from the planet that Nibbler was on.
Nice.
Yeah.
What a hack.
Planetary collapse. Oh, where'd you get that from, Tony Gilroy?
Oh, an authoritarian empire, like going in and stealing resources from an privileged lower rank situation. That's never happened before.
The dupe is completely neutral, though. Just pointing that
Got
out.
Got it. Okay.
I haven't watched any of the episodes until literally last night, but I've been seeing all the memes online, and yeah, there were so many like memes and references to the administration, like, oh, this is clearly what they're doing. These are the meetings they're having, or this is what, you know, such and such a space has looked like behind the scenes when, you know, they had this meeting talking about bombing Ukraine or whatever.
Yeah.
There's a ton of parallels between
it's this a more interesting empire where it's not, they're not just like bloodthirsty killing machines. They're a political organization, and they care about the politics of things. They're not overly powerful. Propaganda is very important. It's a much more interesting empire, and it's very reflective of many fascist organizations that have existed in history. I love it. So after this, actually, we should mention that Daedra and Partagaz are here, and Krennic consults with Daedra, and she offers a plan to his objectives, which is to embed a radical insurgency on Gorman, and which would help their messaging and you know, say like basically paint the Gormans as evil, I think, but we'll see what happens with that.
But I mean, that's analogous to potentially what's happening now, where you have the North Koreans or the Russians posting on Twitter as Americans saying, you know, I hate electric vehicles or climate change isn't real. Like those are real easy things to do, right? Like how much would it cost a government to pay a bunch of people to go on Twitter and pretend to be anti-EV, right? Like that would be super simple and it's really effective. Like the parallels, I think, are when you see it in real life and then you see it on TV, like it doesn't feel nearly as far-fetched as it would have 10 years ago, right? You're like, oh, crap, that's...
Yeah, let's move on from the real-world examples and move on to something fantastical, which is a farming planet with undocumented immigrants that are trying to just make a living while an authoritarian government tries to round them up. And yeah, so let's move away from reality and go to... you know, a more fantastical situation. We're back on the farming planet of Mina Rao, and they're trying to hide from the Empire that's coming in to do like spot checks. And really, we're just seeing the beginnings of this. Like, you know, I think it's just tense at this point. I'm tempted to like move forward in the story, but I don't think we get much farther in this first episode.
This didn't even register to me because it's so quick. So if there's more there, it's not in the first episode.
No, this just lays the groundwork for, you know, oh, there's an audit coming and what are they going to do? How are they going to hide from the Empire?
Okay.
So
also, we get a couple of choice scenes of B2 just being really sad.
Really whiny, yeah.
There's a quick cut back to the wedding venue.
Yes.
And it's Luthen talking to Clea, and he's really worried, like, where is Cassian? We haven't heard from him in a long time. And he basically tells Clea, he's like, keep listening on that radio. He's very worried that Cassian hasn't resurfaced. Like, he expected him to check in. I mean, it was a quick, like, 15, 20-second thing, but he was, like, really worried. Keep listening. We need to know where this dude is. So yeah, Luthen is very worried about the status of Cassian.
Yeah, they haven't heard from him. He's stranded on that planet with those rebels, and they're fighting. I think there was one more little tidbit of Take Holma talking with Mon Mothma. He says that he, like, split up with his wife, and he's feeling unappreciated, which is important. It comes up later. So they also find out that Leda, her daughter, and the fiancé had their first fight.
Did you write down, what was the fight over?
Holding hands.
I read, yeah, like, she's, like, in this gigantic ballroom sitting down, like, sobbing, and her mom has to come and comfort her. She's like, what's going on? And he was like, oh, well, he's, what is she, like, he's such a brute, or he's, anyway, she's like, well, why are you mad? Like, well, he wouldn't hold my hand. Like, oh, my God. Like,
makes you hate him, right? Every single one of them, their whiny little asses. Well, oh, it's so hard, all this fancy stuff, and he won't hold my hand. I hate him.
I don't know how old Leda is supposed to be, but as someone, as like the parent of a 16-year-old, like, that totally rang true. Like, oh my gosh, like, yeah, this, yeah, the end of the world. Like, this kid didn't hold your hand. Like, you might as well call the wedding off. Like, anyway,
it's and it comes, it echoes later, that same sort of sentiment of like, Mon Mothma's in this, like, really tense situation with rebels and fascist governments. And her daughter is the one that's, like, you know, just distraught over what's going on in her life and just the difference there. And the Mon Mothma character just trying to comfort and console her daughter and just tell her it's going to be okay. And just the difference there. I love the dynamics there. Just the echoes of real life situations, but in a heightened reality. And it's just so good.
But, like, that's the perfect example of a scene that didn't need to exist. But, like, I think that's what Tony Gilroy does so well, is this really silly throwaway idea of this teenager basically having a temper tantrum.
Yeah.
And her mom, who is basically this
sacrificing everything.
She's senator who has to, like, you know, she's dealing with all these, like, real world problems. Yeah. But she also has to, like, take a break and deal with her daughter and be like, it's okay, honey. I understand that he didn't hold your hand. Like, she has, like, like you said, she's operating in two totally different spheres of reality, you know?
Yeah. As a parent, you kind of, I mean, I don't necessarily sacrifice everything, but, like, you kind of would sacrifice everything for your kid. And you wouldn't give two cents about what you're going through if your daughter is, or son is in distress. So, yeah, I don't know. They captured that in such a stark way. I loved it.
How old is Bailey now?
She's going on 10.
I assume this girl's, whatever, 16, 17. Like, you call me in 16 or in 6 years and tell me if that isn't an exact scene from your house on any random Thursday. I'm telling you, like, that was 100% real.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the complete... Anybody that's had kids understands, like, the idea of teenagers melting down because literally the world is ending and it's over something just completely mundane, like, I got a C on a test. And you're just like, I can't tell you how many times I've had conversations with my kids where they're like, this is the end of the world. Just how can I possibly go on from this? And I'm looking at them going, dude, I'm trying to make the car payment. I'm trying to get 13 different places. And, you know, grandma's sick. Like, I don't have time to deal with you not turning in your homework, but you have to. Like, that rang 1,000% true.
You do, like, for your kid, you're like, I just want to do everything I can to make their hurt go away, you know, in a sense. But, like, yeah.
But it's just not real life. And that's what Mon Mothma's dealing with. And she was like, look, man, I could be in the Senate right now brokering these massive deals, but no, I've got to pretend like you're not getting your hand held is the end of the world.
Yeah, did you want to comment on that at all, Doug, or just talk about this last scene right before it ends about the daughter situation? Or it seemed like you had something, but
Oh, I hate her.
You hate her. Okay.
That's
no
all.
Empathy whatsoever. Okay, got
moving
it.
Along.
That's what I'm, we're just taking rich that. Bitch. Doug hates I mean, everyone.
They're Nepo babies. It's true.
That's true. I mean, that's what this boils down to. Is there's just a bunch of rich kids who didn't get their way, right?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. All Chandralones are just a bunch of rich kids who didn't get their way with their stupid culture and their stupid customs. The Empire right. should just anyway, Death Star their planet.
We'll talk more about that dynamic in a later episode because it's so good how it comes back. But
so there's one final scene. Yeah, the last right? scene. The yep. last scene is basically Cassian back on, was that Yavin?
Yep.
And the rebels are basically infighting with themselves about whatever. The leader got killed and who should be the secondary leader, who gets to... And they literally get in a shouting match a foot away from each other's faces. One of them pulls a gun. They shoot 2, 3, 4 of them, probably end up dying. I mean, it's like a Mexican standoff kind of thing. And then... Like Cassian sees his chance and tries to run away, and then they tackle him, and then star wipe, and the episode's over, right?
Well, half run to their old broken ship, and right. then the other half go to the TIE fighter.
Is that really clarified in this episode?
Maybe not as much. Yeah, okay. You wouldn't get that impression. Well, because it's okay. chaotic at the end, but
there may be more to that, but yeah. They do split.
They kind
of
split up.
I guess
up,
there yeah. is a quick scene of some of the rebels are in that experimental ship and they're debating whether or not they should let Cassian fly it because they don't know how to fly it. And they're like, well, what if we just let Cassian get it off the ground and then we take over? And they're like, no, we don't trust him. He's going to ditch us or whatever. So, I mean, again, they don't trust Cassian. They don't trust themselves. Hmm. Like this whole thing is in upheaval, right?
Yeah, they are not organized or professional or disciplined or anything that they need to be to try and take on an organization like the Empire.
Is that where this is going? Like you start out at episode one where they're a ragtag group of people that can't get their crap together and then last episode they blow up the Death Star or whatever? I mean, we know that.
You can go back to season one. There were still elements of that. Remember when Cassian joined that rebel group as the pilot when they were planning the theft of all the credits mm-hmm. and stuff? I mean, that was clearly another instance of motivated people that lacked discipline, training, and leadership. And Vel mm-hmm. tried to step into that role, but she sucked. And it kind of got thrust on Cassian to step into the leadership role.
I mean, clearly they get some sort of organization, but...
Yeah, no. Yeah,
I think the point is that even in a quote-unquote organized group like that, there is going to be dissension and there's going to be infighting no matter what, right?
True.
I mean, even in the most well-oiled machine.
But this
if you don't have
here.
That authoritarian, what do they call it, like authority on violence, like if you're not in an authoritarian regime, you don't have that threat of violence that's going to take control of the chain of command that you do have in a fascist organization. It's just a rebel group that has, people and, not always in line.
Okay.
They're rebels right now, but there is no alliance. There's no official rebel group. I mean, that's my opinion, is that's what this whole series is about, is how did the rebellion congeal into a unified front to fight the Empire?
Do we know, does Mon Mothma actually end up becoming the de facto leader of the rebellion?
She was in A New Hope.
I mean, she runs that mission briefing. I mean, I think everybody kind of defers to her. Is that... Okay. I mean, that makes sense that's where it's going, is that she's going to be forced into this impossible situation. Nobody can get along, and she has to take this leadership role.
In fairness, once they did organize, they were probably looking for like a DEI hire.
Wow. Okay.
But what's important, so you remember there was two people kind of vying for leadership in those rebel groups. One of them is Tony Gilroy's son.
Oh,
just
really?
Wanted to say that. That's
Forrest
the most
Whitaker?
Important. Huh?
What?
Forrest Whitaker's not in this episode.
The blonde one with the beard, he's Tony Gilroy's. So, I mean, I think the series, like you said, it's about the rebels coming together. I think it's more about just Tony Gilroy.
It's an excuse for Tony Gilroy to put his
family
in projects.
You know, Dan Gilroy's in there somewhere,
Tony Gilroy's kid needs a paycheck.
I'd rather be in a Mexican standoff on Yavin than in like a 3-day wedding ceremony.
All right. Well, that's it. It's been about an hour-ish. Anything else before we wrap it up?
Final thoughts and score.
Are we going to score? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
We got to score it.
I mean, I'll go first, I guess. I thought it was excellent. High marks for this first episode, especially that first escape scene. Some of the best Star Wars, just in general, Star Wars imagery I've ever seen. Like, just all the set design. Just it's so Star Wars without being, like, kitschy and, like product-y, you know? It feels organic, but also really well manufactured. I don't know. It's just crazy how good it looks. So I'll give this first one like a 9.5. Pretty good. What do you think?
I'll give it like an 8.5. It was a really solid episode. Not a whole lot happened. It's clearly just set up. I mean, I feel like we said the same thing last season. I mean, it's the first episode. They're clearly setting up a lot of these plot points. I thought it was gorgeous. It's a great way to tell a story. Tony Gilroy, yeah, good stuff. Clearly knows what he's doing. 8.5.
Yeah, I'd probably go 8.5 as well. Maybe leaning more towards a 9. It felt great to have the show back and to be watching Andor again. The look of it, the feel of it, it's a great show. Pacing-wise, I was impressed with how they kept things interesting and moving, but it's always a challenge in the series where you got to set up. Well, that's just it. You have to establish your foundation, your setup for where the story is going, and that usually drags things down. All that exposition can get a little slow. So he did a great job of not letting it get bogged down. It was a little slow in some parts, the wedding scenes. But overall, yeah, solid episode. Had me hyped for the rest of the season.
One thing, and I think we'll wrap it up, is this season had the potential to be terrible. We said it was 3 years between the last one. I don't know if you remember, but it was scheduled to come out like 2 years ago and they pushed it back. Like, I don't remember the details. Disney didn't want to give them as much money or whatever. So they had to push all the scheduling back, which means that all of your actors may not be available. You know, they may have another job because I was scheduled to film in whatever 2022 and it didn't happen until 2023, but I got this other contract. So like there was a massive potential to lose your writers, to lose your actors, just to lose your momentum. So when they announced that back in the day, I was really worried. I'm like, this could be the end of the show because you're going to have to get a whole new group of people or, you know, whatever, half of your actors can't come back and then you have to write them out of the script. So
you remember that controversy during the writer's strike? They were...
Oh, that's right. It was the writer's strike. Yeah.
That Tony Gilroy was going to continue filming because he said everything was written, but then there was a huge pushback against that. And so he said, okay, we'll stop production. Because it is true, a lot of times you have to like recreate or rewrite things on the day of shooting and stuff. So that was like a big delay, I think, the strike. And they switched up their idea because they were going to do 5 seasons, right? And they switched it to 1 season with, you know, cram everything into 1 season. So it's just kind of a miracle that the show has come out.
It's a miracle that it came out and that it was as strong as it was. And I've only seen the first episode. So
yeah.
Props to you, Tony Gilroy. All right.
That's ready? 3, 2, 1.
Logic gate out.
Did you do it together?
Rad.